Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session, pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. Our first case is 11-619, the State of Ohio versus Jason Williams for the appellant, Ms. Sobieski.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor and Justices, and may it please the Court. I'm Kristen Sobieski from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office here on behalf of the State of Ohio. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honors, I respectfully submit that this case presents yet another important issue when it comes to allied offense analysis and review in the State of Ohio. And that issue is, what is the appropriate standard of a review that an appellate court should be applying when reviewing a trial court's determination that offenses are not allied? And the state is submitting to the court that the appropriate standard that should be applied is that of an abuse of discretion. Where the trial court has gone through and has held a hearing prior to imposing the sentence, the trial court has sat through the evidence and the testimony of the trial, has heard the arguments with regard to the allied offenses from the parties, and that court then makes a ruling based on the facts that have been presented. Must a reviewing court give deference to that trial court's findings of fact? And the only possible answer to that question is yes. Courts of appeals in the state of Ohio must be required to give deference to the trial court's findings of fact when it comes to allied offense appellate review. Abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard. It prevents the appellate court from simply substituting its own judgment for that of the trial court. In practice, allied offense analysis, these challenges are not always litigated in the first instance in the trial court. Sometimes it is raised for the first time in an appeal. However, in this case, it was addressed by the trial court prior to sentencing. The court went through all of the appropriate steps, made some factual determinations, and yet upon appeal, that decision was reversed without giving any deference to those factual findings by the trial court.
What happens when you have issues of law that are intertwined? Do you deal with those on a different standard, or do you give deference on the issues of law? What is the standard?
The de novo review, as was applied by the appellate court in this case, would be appropriate if it were merely a question of law. But the determination, and for example, whether two offenses are of similar import or dissimilar import, that might be a question of law. In other words, does a trial court need to go further and review conduct to determine whether there was a separate act or a separate animus? That's where it becomes a factual determination. The legal determination of whether the offenses are similar enough to begin with that we even need to go into those factual findings, that perhaps might be subject to a de novo review. However, when we come down to, we know these two, in the offenses that were the subject of this case, the rape and the kidnapping, there's no question that these are offenses that must be further examined. The conduct must be further examined to determine whether they were committed separately or with a specific separately punishable intent, that separate animus.
Does an appellate court ever have to give deference to a trial court's legal conclusions, or is that always a different standard?
De novo review is typically the standard of review that is applied when it is strictly a legal determination. And that is where the error occurred in this case was when the appellate court applied the de novo standard to the factual findings of the trial court. The appellate court should have been free to review the trial court's determination. Does this kidnapping, are they similar enough offenses that we need to look at separate act and separate animus? That was the legal determination that may have been appropriately subject to de novo review by the District Court of Appeals. However, when it came down to reviewing the actual conduct of the defendant, the criminal acts, the facts of the case, and making those fact determinations of separate act and separate animus, that should be subject to an abuse of discretion.
In this instance, there were two offenses. Is that right? Kidnapping and rape?
There were, yes, two counts of rape and
kidnapping. What was the animus for the kidnapping, in your view?
The animus, referring to that his immediate motive in the kidnapping. Now, the kidnapping is that moving of the victim from the first location to the...
I know what kidnapping is. We know that the individual, the child, was on the porch. She was carried or taken against her will behind a garage.
Yes.
And then she was raped. Correct?
That's right.
My question is, what was the animus in taking her behind the garage?
To move her from the first location to the second location, he was trying to further secret this activity that was going on, perhaps to get out of earshot, get further away from where he might be seen, might be caught, might be interrupted. There is a specific, separate intent that is separately punishable.
For what purpose?
Removing.
For what purpose? To secrete her. To take her out of earshot for what purpose?
Because he was not done with his sexual contact and sexual conduct against her.
He hadn't even done the sexual contact yet.
That's actually, the first rape occurred prior. The victim's testimony about when he put his mouth on her, that is at the first location. Then she is moved to the second location where additional sexual conduct and contact
occurred. Was she kidnapped twice?
In theory...
If
Your
she
Honor.
Was transported from the place where she was found, that would be a kidnapping, removing her from the porch to behind the garage. And then while she was restrained during the course of the rape, wouldn't that be a second kidnapping?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was
actually,
there an indictment returned for the second kidnapping?
No, there was not. And actually, Your Honor, if I may, I would suggest that there could be three, the restraint of the victim with the first
Well, the fact
act.
Is your office only returned one indictment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What
I
did
believe...
the indictment or the bill of particulars say with respect to what the activity was that composed the kidnapping that you indicted?
The kidnapping, the theory of the case throughout was that the kidnapping was the movement of the victim from the first location to the second location.
So what we look at in the test of allied offenses is whether or not one offense can be committed with the same conduct as the other.
Yes.
So is it your view that there were separate acts committed, one in removing the victim and a second one in committing a rape, an assault on her?
Yes. There's
two acts of conduct, and what I'm having difficulty with is determining, after we reach that question, whether there is a separate animus for each of those actions.
Yes.
And you haven't clarified in my mind why there are two separate, why there is a separate animus for each and not one animus to commit the activity. So if you could help me understand that, it would help me make a decision in the case.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll try. The idea that the first sexual contact occurred at the first location, the fact that he had to stop, remove the victim to another location before continuing his conduct demonstrates that he had an additional criminal intent to move her for a purpose beyond simply committing the sexual conduct and sexual contact. He was already doing that. He needed to move her, secrete her to another location, albeit it was within the same yard, in order to continue his attack on this 8-year-old girl. It is the fact that he moved her, the conduct of moving her to another location, as well as the intent. The only possible animus that he would have, why remove her to any other location except to further secrete his actions, to prevent interruption, to prevent anyone from seeing or hearing, to remove her to...
Counsel, Didn't the 8th District, though, find that the issue was with the indictment? Because the indictment actually adds a sexual motivation to the kidnapping. Had the indictment simply said kidnapping, you might be in a different place. But clearly, when looking at the animus, the indictment alleges the sexually motivated kidnapping for purposes of furtherance of the rape.
Yes, and my response to that, Your Honor, is this. The inclusion of a sexual motivation specification with the charge of kidnapping in the indictment is not an expression of the state's belief or understanding that the rape and the kidnapping share the same animus. The point of the sexual motivation specification to be included in that indictment, there are sentencing ramifications that can become of that. When you include a sexual motivation specification with a kidnapping charge, that means you can also include a sexually violent predator specification with the kidnapping charge. You need to have the sexual motivation specification to be able to attach the sexually violent predator specification. Ultimately, in this case, the trial court found that he was not guilty of the sexually violent predator specifications that were attached to the two rape counts and to the two kidnapping counts. Having that sexual motivation specification on the kidnapping charge was for that purpose. It's not a statement. I think that's sort of a red herring in the case in terms of, you know, the 8th District deciding whether these offenses are allied or not based on that is it is inaccurate in my view. That's not the purpose of that specification to say that we think that these acts are committed with the same animus.
Is there a higher penalty under the general kidnapping for the purpose to engage in sexual activity as opposed to kidnapping without that purpose?
With a sexual motivation specification and not getting into the sexually violent predator, but yes, if you have a finding of the sexual motivation with a kidnapping charge and the victim is under the age of 13, there is a requirement of some mandatory time of 15 years. Again, that wasn't was not applicable to this defendant because there was no finding. The sexual motivation specification and found him not guilty of the sexually violent predator specification. But yes, that would be one of the consequences. That is the purpose of having that specification on that count.
And we also have a child involved here, and we know that in these kind of cases, the evidence and the testimony can be somewhat tenuous, and the credibility of the child is often challenged. If you have a charge of kidnapping for the purpose of engaging in sexual activity, is it more likely that you would be able to still obtain a conviction even though for the kidnapping, even though the rape charge may fall apart based on the testimony or the uncertainty of the child or the inability of the child to testify, so that you would still be able to at least prove one of the charges?
Yes. Most often with any, you know, rape charge, there is going to be a restraint because of that force part of the rape. There is going to be also a restraint of the victim. So that is why kidnapping and rape are charged together. They may not always be separately punishable, but yes, they are frequently are charged together, and they may or may not both be proven at trial.
Well, in the kidnapping, you have to simply prove to engage in sexual activity, you have to prove that was the purpose. You don't have to, in a rape, you have to prove it was actually occurred. So there's different elements of proof involved, right?
That is true. That is true. I see that I've gotten into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to see if the remainder of my name. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Garber.
Good morning. My name is Jonathan Garber. I represent the appellee, Jason Williams. May it please the court. This court has gone to great lengths to fashion a workable test to determine whether multiple offenses are subject to merger under Revised Code Section 294125. Just a little over a year ago, a new test was established with the objective of obtaining clear, predictable results. In this appeal, the court will likely establish the parameters for appellate review of decisions involving merger. This court has a choice. By adopting a de novo standard of review, the court can give important guidance to the trial courts of this state and assure uniformity, consistency, and predictability in merger decisions. Pelley respectfully asserts that by adopting an abuse of discretion standard, it will result in a hodgepodge of decisions and undermine the recent progress made by this court in clarifying the law of merger doctrine. Without the discipline of meaningful appellate review, much of what this court has accomplished in recent years will be lost. I'd like to begin, if I may, by discussing the difference between factual determinations made by a trial court, which are entitled to deference by appellate courts, and factual analysis related to the application of the law to the facts. In the case of factual determinations that are entitled to deference by appellate courts, the trial court is observing the demeanor of the witnesses, making decisions about the credibility of the witnesses, and weighing the evidence. That's not what occurred in this case. The facts in this case were determined by the jury. In this case, the trial court engaged in a factual analysis of applying the law to the facts of this particular case. And this court and the appellate courts of this state are as well equipped as the trial court to conduct that analysis. And traditionally, that's what has been done. If you look at the previous decisions by this court involving the merger doctrine, this court has analyzed the facts and applied the law, and that is something that is traditionally subject to de novo review. I'd also like to just comment about the facts of this particular case. There were actually five sex offenses committed in this case, but there was one kidnapping charge, and that charge was accompanied by a sexual motivation specification. There was one uninterrupted, continuous course of conduct that took place over just a few minutes. It started when the victim escorted my client to an area in the backyard near her grandmother's car because she
Well, she wasn't escorted, was she?
No, at this part of the events, she was escorting him to show him a bumper sticker on the back of a car. And that's where the sexual misconduct began. Shortly thereafter, he took her by the hand, and he escorted her to a different location in the backyard where the sexual
act. And do you think that constituted a kidnapping?
There was a kidnapping at every point along the way.
So when you say he escorted her or took her by the hand and went behind the garage, it's at least a generous view of what was going on.
Well, it was a kidnapping.
All right, so he kidnapped her and he took her behind the garage, right?
Correct. And each time he committed a sex offense, it was a kidnapping, a restraint of liberty. And there are two cases.
So is it for me, the question becomes whether or not the action of taking her behind the garage is the same conduct as committing the act of rape.
Well,
saying it is?
I'm saying it's incidental to the commission of the underlying offense, and it does not have any substantial independent significance. There was no...
Would it ever?
Could it ever?
Would it ever?
It could, as you pointed out in your concurring opinion in the Johnson case, citing the Ware case, where there was an abduction by deception. A woman was taken from her girlfriend's house a great distance to the defendant's house for the sole purpose of committing a rape.
And the question I have then becomes, is it the distance we're going to measure for incidental versus another crime? What standard should we promulgate for trial judges to look at?
There are several relevant factors which have been discussed in the earlier decisions of this case and which were discussed in the Ware case when it distinguished the Price case. In the Price case, a woman was taken from the back seat of a car a short distance away behind some bushes where she was raped. And in the Price case, the court held that those offenses were merged because there was no prolonged restraint of the victim. The movement of the victim was not over a substantial distance, and it was merely incidental to the commission of the rape. And I would submit that that case much more closely resembles the current case where all of this sexual activity took place over a very short period of time and over a very in a very confined area. And I would remind the court of the Chief Justice's language in the Johnson case, where he declined to parse the defendant's conduct blow by blow in order to sustain the state's desire to have multiple convictions in that case. This was an ugly transaction. Nobody's going to be arguing about that. But this was one continuous, uninterrupted event over a short period of time. And if you look at all of the criteria established by this court in State versus Craig, they all suggest that the offenses should merge in this particular case. The case you cited in your concurring opinion in the Ware case, where there was a kidnapping by deception over a long period of distance and over a significant period of time, is distinguishable and is not controlling in this case.
Is it your opinion that if we do not go to a de novo standard and we do abuse of discretion, if we applied abuse of discretion to these facts, that you would lose because there was sufficient for the trial court on an abuse of discretion to reach its decision?
No, I believe that even if the court were to adopt an abuse of discretion standard, the decision of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed. The trial court in this case abused its discretion for several reasons. First, it applied the wrong standard. It applied the standard set forth in State versus Rance, and we're now operating under the standard established by State versus Johnson. Secondly, in applying the law to the facts, those decisions are always subject to de novo review. And I don't understand how the trial court could conclude that there was a separate animus for the kidnapping offense when we have a single kidnapping charge that relates to all five sex offenses.
Well, the court explained that because it said there is a separate animus for it, because if he had kidnapped her by removing her to the back of the garage, but then been interrupted and ultimately did not commit rape upon her, there would still be a kidnapping. So it said separate conduct, and the kidnapping would have been complete. So that was the analysis in any event that the trial court used to determine that these constituted two different courses of conduct.
You're correct. That's the analysis the trial court used, but that analysis is not compatible.
Why is that a faulty analysis?
Because in the Johnson case, this court held that the question is whether the kidnapping and the rape can possibly be committed at the same time, not whether one can be committed without the other being committed. And The kidnapping statute talks about restraint of liberty, and it talks about removal. And it doesn't accord either any more significance. And whether it's purely restraint or a removal a short distance, there's just no question that the restraint and the removal in this case, as it relates to all five sex offenses, was solely for the purpose of facilitating the commission of the sex offense.
Was there a separate kidnapping at the time that merged with the rape in terms of the restraint after the victim was behind the garage, in your view?
Well, the
indicted, according to the prosecutors here.
Yeah, I'm going to go by the state's theory that there was one kidnapping, one continuous kidnapping.
So the state would not, in your view, be permitted to return a separate indictment for rape and kidnapping if this all wholly occurred behind the garage?
Well, they could have.
There could have been another indictment for kidnapping, and then you would argue that would have merged with the rape because that is the same conduct.
Correct. There could have been five indictments for kidnapping, and it would be my position that all five kidnapping charges would merge with the sex offense charges.
Thank you.
Your client received a concurrent sentence?
Correct.
So you're really looking at what the underlying final charges end up looking like rather than the length of the sentence in this appeal.
Well, in terms of the amount of time my client will serve, your decision in this case will have no impact on my client whatsoever.
But it's the idea of the analysis under Johnson that should occur. And the problem is it starts with the conduct, which seems to imply fact-finding of some type. That there's an identification of what conduct occurred and whether it was a single or multiple act. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would say there is factual analysis involved in applying the law in any particular case. But I would distinguish that from factual findings made by a trial court, for example, in a motion to suppress, which involves a mixed question of law and fact. Trial court hears the evidence, observes the witnesses, weighs the credibility, determines the credibility of the evidence, and weighs the evidence, and then applies the law to the facts as determined. And the courts have held that the factual determinations in that context are entitled to deference, but the application of the law to the facts are reviewable de novo. And in this case, there were no factual determinations made by the trial court. The facts were determined by the jury. And all the trial court did was, or attempt to do, was apply the law to the facts of the case. And that decision should be reviewable by the appellate courts de novo.
Would it make any difference if this were a bench trial and the court was finding facts as to what occurred chronologically, let's say, first this happened and then we had this happen? Is that a different situation?
I believe it would be. I believe the factual determinations made by the court would be entitled to deference in that situation.
So we have to look at the course of conduct first, and then if we get to the point of discussing animus, that also, in your view, would be a matter of law, correct?
Yes.
And does it have any significance in this case, as Justice Brown was speaking of, with respect to the indictment having the sexual motivation specification in it?
I think it's of enormous consequence. I think not only the sexual motivation specification, but the fact that there was but a single charge of kidnapping. And I think the state is hard-pressed, after indicting the case that way, to claim that to isolate one of the five kidnappings that occurred here and focus on that and attempt to impose multiple punishments because of that. There was a case I cited in my brief where a husband raped his wife on multiple occasions, first standing near the bed where he's restraining her of her liberty, and then he moves her onto the bed. So how much legal significance are we going to place upon that movement onto the bed, or in this case, the movement of the victim a few feet in the backyard? And again, I hearken back to the language of the Chief Justice in the Johnson case, where he declined to parse into a blow-by-blow analysis the facts in order to sustain multiple convictions. This was a horrible crime. There were multiple crimes committed. He was convicted of all of them. Was he guilty of kidnapping? Yes. But in substance and effect, the kidnapping was not a separate and distinct offense, and he should not be subject to multiple punishments on these facts. Thank you.
Sobieski.
Counsel, does the record indicate how far the child was removed from the first location to the second location?
Exactly the amount of feet. I don't think that that can be gleaned from the record. There were some photographs that were also introduced that showed at least where the houses were, and she circled, you know, where she was to start, which one was her house, circled where she was when she was at the second location between the houses. Perhaps from those the court could, you know, but in terms of number of feet or anything like that, I don't think we have that information in the record before us. Briefly, to respond to this idea of the facts are only found by the jury in this case, I don't think that's actually consistent with this court's opinion in Johnson. There's a portion of that opinion where the court discusses that the trial court has to remove the evidence that has come in through the trial. And so this idea of abusive discretion or de novo review certainly would not depend on whether or not this was a bench trial or a jury trial. In either case, the court is going to have to independently review the facts and evidence that have come in a way that goes beyond what the jury has done in order to make their findings of guilt.
Counsel, are you saying that the time that the trial court is determining whether or not to merge, it does a de novo review of the facts as found by the jury?
I'm saying that it does is considering those facts in a way that the jury has not and should not be considering them. That is, the determination of allied offenses is strictly up to the court, not to the jury.
But it cannot find a fact that the jury has not found.
No, it can't go beyond and find a fact that the jury has not. But in this case, the jury found him guilty of all of the counts, the three gross sexual impositions, the two rapes, and the kidnapping. The court is looking at that same evidence that the jury considered, but is looking at that same evidence in a different way to determine
the appropriate punishment, not the conviction. He
right.
will be convicted of each and every one of these counts.
Absolutely.
Whether he will be sentenced on each and every conviction, on each and every count that resulted in a conviction, is the question.
Absolutely. Yes. But the trial court is making factual findings in order to find the separate act and the separate animus. There are factual findings that are being made by the trial court. Trial judge must look at the evidence that has come in order to make those factual findings. This case,
the factual findings would pertain to the separate animus, right? Because there could be a question of whether, not necessarily it's an allied offense, but whether it's of similar import.
Yes,
I mean,
Your Honor.
One is doing something for the purpose, then the second one is actually doing that purpose. So one could argue that maybe they're not of similar import.
In order
I know you're not doing that in this case, but
yes.
But that would be a legal question, would it not?
Similar or dissimilar import might be a legal question that could be reviewed de novo, yes. But in terms of separate act and separate animus, those are factual findings that are made by the trial court. We're asking that this court find that abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard of review. The trial court, these decisions should be made in the first instance in the trial court. The trial court is in the best position to review the facts and make these factual determinations. So I think that in order to give the full effect to Johnson, the trial court should be given afforded this discretion, afforded the deference when it comes to appeal, when it makes separate act, separate animus findings. I think this will provide uniformity in this particular area of the law. So I do respectfully request that you adopt the state's proposition of law. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Thank you very much.